Hello and welcome. I am happy to be here with all of you. One of the things I want to talk about actually today is the role of words and understanding and speech and in the consideration of reality and the possibility of the realization of freedom, and actually the role of words and ideas and understandings in the whole arena of what we call self-realization. I remember that when I first heard the term self-realization, which I'm not sure, but I think that it is a translation of the Sanskrit term jnana, which, by the way, is also the root of the Greek word gnosis, and thereby Gnostic and so forth, knowledge. But when I first heard the term self-realization, I remember that I thought that was a lot better than enlightenment. I like that a lot better. It seemed to have a more esoteric and highfalutin sound to it. Seemed to have the aura of special knowledge to it. And I, so that I invested in that word a kind of magical component to it, which of course is what we do with words always anyway. We have this inclination that comes God knows from where to think of words as the gateway to understanding and clarity, and in the spiritual arena, the gateway to realization, to self-realization, a state which we, or at least in my case, I imagine to be outside of, apart from normal human experience and normal human state. And that belief, that love affair with the idea of realization did me no good at all. If it had any effect at all, it was to delay the day when I was done with suffering and misery. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the way I use words and the way, you know, I'm kind of known for not being very patient and tolerant of spiritual talk. So I want to talk a little bit about words and how I see them and what I think is true and false about them. I'm going to start by reading to you a little bit of an article that I came upon the other day in the New Yorker magazine. And this has nothing whatsoever to do with spiritual attainment or spiritual ideas, but it contains what is one of the clearest and most exquisite evocations of what we speak of as realization that I have read. The article itself purports to be on the surface about wine tasting and perfume and the general difficulty in communicating and making understandable what are extremely subjective and individualistic sense experiences. And it goes like this, begins like this. For years, ever since I started taking an interest in wine, I've been annoyed by the word grainy. It's a word that mavens use in relation to red wines and refers to certain types of tannin. The chemical that cures leather is present in tea and makes the mouth pucker. Tannin is a preservative and an important factor in the way wines age. Still, how could a liquid be grainy? Then a few nights ago, I opened a bottle of wine I'd been given from the European heat wave year of 2003, and without concentrating very hard, took a sip, noticed something odd about the mouthfeel of the wine, and suddenly realized, bam, that was grainy. I'd found the famous grainy tannins, and the term actually made sense because the wine definitely had a particulate, almost sand-like texture. Not unpleasant, but distinctive. What's more, in tasting it, I realized that I'd encountered versions of it, milder, more restrained versions before. And now I knew what grainy tannins were. Most taste experiences work like that. A taste or a smell can pass you by, unremarked or nearly so in large part, because you don't have a word for it. Then you see the thing and grasp the meaning of a word at the same time, and both your palate and your vocabulary have expanded. One day you catch the smell of gooseberries from a Sauvignon Blanc, or red currants from a Cabernet, or bubble gum from a Gamay, or horse manure from a Shiraz, and from that point on you know exactly what people mean when they say they detect these things. Once it has been pointed out to you, you never forget. This is what's meant by realization. Just this. Just this. We hear from so many sources over really our entire lifetimes, although for most of our lifetime we are unaware of hearing these things, but we hear throughout our lifetime references to the possibility of enlightenment, of freedom, of or maybe we just contain within us the recognition that we are free. And we hear the things that resonate with that. We hear them throughout our lifetime, and then finally at some point we find ourselves seeking what it is that these words are pointing to for ourself in some spiritual arena, in some spiritual practice. And once we get into the spiritual arena, and once we get into a spiritual practice, then we begin to hear the whole range of expression that has tried to describe the actual nature of reality, the actual nature of freedom that we are, the actual nature of the indestructible, eternal, shining light that we are. We hear these descriptions and these words and these ideas and so forth, and they ring true with us. They resonate with us. Somehow they seem like they're true, like there's something true to them. Like if we drink red wine and we hear of the characteristic grainy, there's something about that, even if we don't know what it is, there's something about that that rings true, that a red wine could be described, that's one of the characteristics could be described as graininess. Likewise, in our own consciousness and in our own lives, we hear the word enlightenment, and we hear the word self-realization or freedom or emptiness or any of those things. And there's something about that, we can't quite put our finger on it, but there's something about that that seems to ring true. And when we read or hear directly from those who have experience with these matters, we hear them talk about these things in the words and the concepts and the ideas that are accessible to them, that they have themselves received and understood in their own lifetimes, in their own culture, in their own circumstances. And they try to tell us what it is that they're talking about. And it rings true, kind of. Otherwise, why would we be here? It rings true. There's something about it that makes sense. And we want to know how we can get that for ourselves. And all the rest of the conversation that pretty much takes place within the spiritual arena is conversation about how can we get that, how can we get it back, how can we feel like this person is describing his own feelings, how can we get rid of our ignorance, how can we destroy what needs to be destroyed that stands in the way of our true selves, and all of those things. All the rest of the conversation is around what we imagine to be transmitted by the utterances of these beings who have had direct experience of their own in these areas. So that still we find that realization is a kind of magical word, or enlightenment, or I don't know, whatever might be the term that speaks to you. And we, because of our life experience, we are convinced that if we can just break through in our mind to a clear understanding of what it is that's being talked about, that's what we need. And that if we're doing something else like meditation or pranayama or japa or any of those things, we're doing something else in order to attain realization that the way we'll know when we get it is that our experience, when we get it, will be in compliance and conformance with what we imagine to have been described by those who have described it to us before, the graininess and so forth. And it never is. It is since we are also told that already, without anything changing, without anything being made to stay or to go away or to change or to stop changing, already our state and our actual nature is exactly what it is that we are so desperately trying to make it be. Everything we do in regard to trying to gain what we imagine to be the understanding of things is actually just kind of wasting time, running in place, getting nowhere. Mostly because there's nowhere to be gotten. I'm going to read now a couple of emails that I've received recently, which, from my point of view, when I received them, what we are talking about in these emails and in these letters is how can the interpretation of the nature of realization be corrected or adjusted or transmitted in such a way that it will more effectively serve the goal of my own realization, my own gaining of freedom. But we'll talk about this, or I'll talk about it a little bit. This is my time. You don't have to talk about it. I'll start out with one that's pretty uncomplicated in being precisely about the way that I speak things. John, I lovingly beg to differ with you in a fun way. You say, quote, the only problem to be found anywhere is a false belief about who we are, unquote. But in truth, there is no problem whatsoever to be found anywhere. The core foundation of being is this, quote, there is no problem, unquote. All else mysteriously arises from this premise of no problem. And yet, this all-else business is miraculous, yet illusory. Actually, your teaching is beautiful just as it is. I'm saying exactly what you say, except with a slight twist of emphasizing the no problem. No problem is first and primary. No problem is core. Everything else radiates from this core of no problem, including supposed problems. The most miraculous thing is, all this radiating business is also none other than the core. What a gorgeous mystery. Wow. What a gorgeous mystery indeed. You see, this letter that I received is, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. There's absolutely no way in which this person has said something that is incorrect and that needs to be corrected. It is also true, of course, that there's nothing that this person has said that in any way is descriptive of anything real. These are words about ideas. These are descriptions of descriptions. These are interpretations of what needs no interpretation, what is absolutely ever-presently here. So when I speak to you, for example, when I speak to you and I say the only problem to be found anywhere is a false belief about who we are, well, of course that's not true. Of course there is no problem. And of course it is the case that even the false belief about what we are is not a problem. Even that is not a problem from the viewpoint of the absolute. Of course, it's a big problem from the viewpoint of the relative, and as it should be. But from my viewpoint, all of this is utterly beside the point. You see, the only thing that I want to do, the only thing that I want to do with every word I speak, and I'm not all that good at it, but this is what I want. The only thing I want to do is to be helpful to you in having the realization that realization, the word, describes the actual, ever-present, experiential reality that you are. Just like the word grainy does not mean tiny little pieces of sand in the glass of wine. It means something that is actually inexpressible. And only when you have the experience of the taste of grainy at the same time as you recognize it to be that is being described as grainy, does that word make any sense at all. It's the same with realization. Only when you have the direct conscious experience of the ever-present, unchanging, eternal reality that you are, at the same time as you see that that is what is being spoken of, having that experience consciously is exactly what's being spoken of by the word realization in the spiritual context, only then do you realize what we're talking about, which is you. It's not no problem. It's not problem. It's not not two, and it's not separation. It is you. You. Just as you are, here and now, in this moment, just as you are. And when you see that, then you see what it is that you have believed yourself to be missing all this time by thinking that the word realization or enlightenment or awareness or awakening or any of that means something different than what's already here. So it's for this reason that I pay very little attention to the things that I say. I speak from a heartfelt desire to introduce you to yourself, a heartfelt desire to introduce you to yourself so that you can attend to that from time to time in order to evaporate all confusion and all misunderstanding about what you are. In the evaporation of that, in this light that you are, what goes with it is misery and suffering. The underlying ocean of river of fearfulness and anxiety. So it's not my desire or my ambition in any way to find a new way to speak more clearly about what you already are. My ambition and my desire in all cases is merely to be helpful in evoking for you the ever-present experience of being that you are, and not in order that you can even know yourself to be that, but just in order that that light that comes from looking at that enters your consciousness, enters your personal consciousness, and wipes out this river of fearfulness and anxiety that underlies all of our lives. Okay, another email. I have a question you may have had before, maybe many times. If you have any time to respond directly, please do so. It would make my day. I would love to hear what you think about free will and responsibility. Do you think there is truth in the idea that we can change the world with choice? After seeing the talks you had with Richard Miller on Never Not Here, I got the impression that you're something of a determinist. Do you think everything that happens is destiny? I think we would all like to think we have some influence. If we don't have influence, what's the point of consciousness, one might ask? And are we not drawn to self-inquiry and spirituality in general as a means to change and improve things in the world? But if this power is only illusory, what should our attitude toward morality and choice be? Well, I can only speak from my own experience. And unfortunately, with this, as with everything else, trying to speak from my own experience isn't quite as easy as it sounds, because it's like your own experience is utterly inclusive. In other words, it is... My experience is just like you, the experience of the certainty that I have choice, that there are things that I can choose to do. There are I can choose to put my attention on things and not on other things. Actually, the truth is that in my own experience, after some investigation, it seems to me that the only thing I have a choice about is where I put my attention. But what do I know? You know? I mean, really, what do I know? The literature, and we have such a kind of superstitious relationship with spiritual literature. We I think, give it a presumption of accuracy that it doesn't deserve. After all, spiritual literature is the utterance of us, of you and me, of people just like us, over all of the years that we have been playing in this human world. People just like us, trying and failing to say something real about reality. So, it is true that there is a great deal of discussion in the literature, especially in the Eastern spiritual literature, that asserts that we have no choice, that the entire way in which these lives unfold and play out is beyond our command. And there's a great deal of rational and cogent and convincing argument to be brought to bear to support that view. You know, everything is connected, and everything that arises conditionally. It is affected by everything around it, by everything that comes in contact with it, and everything that comes in contact with everything that comes in contact with it, and so forth. And there's a cogent and convincing argument to be made that the idea that I have a choice as to what I do, what I speak, what I say, what I think, and so forth is false. If I look in my own experience, I see that I can find nothing whatsoever that I can do to change the characteristics and the activity of this personality. I've looked hard, I've seen, and so far as I can see, this life unfolds on its own and has nothing to do with what my thoughts say it should do and my ideas say it should be. But what do I know, really? I speak about these things in these terms like I suppose I must have spoken with Richard Miller. I don't recall the conversation. I speak in these things about these terms because these utterances arise naturally from this underlying desire and ambition to introduce you to yourself. And anything that I can say that will serve that end is fine with me. I know beyond a shadow of doubt that there's nothing I can say that is really true about reality. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if you look for yourself, if you look for yourself, that you will see that the reality that has always been here for yourself, and that you will be no better at describing it than I am. I have no problem with choice. I have no problem with no choice. All of that is beside the point. All of that is descriptions and interpretations of reality. None of it can contain anything true about reality. It is all conditional and purpose-driven. Look for yourself. But if you look for an answer to the question as to whether you have free choice or do not have free choice, that will occupy you and entertain you for a while, but it can do nothing whatsoever about ridding you of the underlying current of fearfulness and anxiety that is the cause of all misery and suffering. It can entertain you, and it can bring you satisfaction of an intellectual sort, but it cannot free you, cannot reveal to you your inherent, innate freedom from fearfulness and anxiety. So it's all beside the point. Don't know. You tell me. And then the last email here. Here is a question for John. So tell me, John, what will it be like in the end? What will in the end be left of the picture I have of myself? What will the story of me be when you, as Ramana did, say that everything... What will be the story of me when you, as Ramana did, say that everything will be all right when I conduct this self-inquiry as often as I can? Somewhere along the line I heard you say, or I read it somewhere, all sharp edges of the eye will disappear. They will be eradicated. And of course I remember you saying, gradually. Thus I sometimes try to imagine what that should feel like. What will become of me through the consequent inquiry of myself? Would Would that be the feeling of knowing how good a person I have become? Or that I have become less discriminative, less violent, less hard-hearted, or more loving and compassionate a person? Is it the great secret of what will be the result of it all, not just the ever-silent, observant, wise, and non-moving nature that has always been and will always be in the core of my presence? Let me try that again. Is the great secret of what will be the result of it all, not just the ever-silent, observant, wise, and non-moving nature that has always been and always will be in the core of my presence? Or is that supposed to be another story of me? I ask you to go deeper in there for me. This is actually quite quite a good question. And the reason it's quite a good question is because in my own experience and so far, it was a question that played very long and continuously in my own mind in those days. And the question is just exactly what he says. What should I feel like? What should I be like? What will it look like? How can I know? And the reason it's great to get this question is because I never asked it. I would have been mortified to ask such a question. I would have felt that it would be exposing my inherent ignorance to ask such a question, which, of course, exposes my inherent ignorance all on its own. And the answer is, as I said last week, the same answer for all questions. The answer is, if you see consciously the reality of what you are, the long-term effect of that will be the gradual easing of fearfulness and anxiety. Now, if you seek the easing of fearfulness and anxiety, then you will be endlessly fearful and anxious lest you fail to get rid of fearfulness and anxiety, and so forth. I can tell you that from my own experience too. The answer to every question is look at yourself. Everything I say, every story I tell, every word I speak, every effort I make to say something coherent to you about what we are has one purpose, and that is to introduce you to the ever-present experience of you. To have you see consciously, knowing that that's what you're seeing in this moment, what it feels like to be you. The reason that I seek to have that happen is because it is my experience that continuous exposure to that ever-present reality is alone what wipes out fearfulness and anxiety in your life. What happens to your life, what happens to the personality, to the actual structure, the apparatus of person and character and history and expectations and so forth and so on, I can't even imagine. Since that structure and that personality itself is entirely conditional, it's entirely shaped and formed and by the environment in which it arises and develops and evolves, it is to be expected that that structure, that apparatus, as it always has been, will change as the experience of fearfulness and anxiety fades away, since it's conditioned, since it is, its shape is determined by the forces that it appears within. When the forces of fearfulness and anxiety depart, you can expect that there will be changes that occur within the personality, within the apparatus, the structure of the personality. You may think that those changes should be to make the personality more saintly-like, or quieter, or clearer, or filled with understanding, or any of that. I tell you, you have no more basis for that than you would have for trying to understand the myriads of forces and conditions that have shaped the personality so far. You could never have predicted when you were 5 years old that you would turn out the way you are now at whatever age you are now. You could never have known that this is what would come of all of your efforts and all of your work and all of the forces that acted upon you throughout your life. Nor can you know what the shape of the personality will be when this current of fearfulness and anxiety is gone. You can be pretty sure that it'll change, because it always changes. And it's my experience that in the absence of fearfulness and anxiety, the changes are all for the better. And they, but not like you might think, much more mundanely than you might think. I do know this, and I think I can tell you that this is something you might actually look forward to, and that is that for me, and I have to tell you that for all of my life, until very recently, the last 10 years or so, for all of my life, I have... And I don't really remember what this feels like, so like the graininess in wine, I'm not really sure that the words I'm using actually say anything true about what I felt, but I have this sense that for all of my life I really hated myself. I really hated the things that were bad about me, and I hated the thoughts I had, and I hated the emotions and the experiences and the all of that. It all was misery and suffering to me. And now, although certainly my personality hasn't changed that much, really, some things are gone, but now I am actually in love with this life. I have fallen in love with life as a human being. I have lost the sense of having to hold my life and my mind and my actions and my thoughts and my desires at arm, lest they cause me hurt, lest they say something terrible about me, lest they describe me as worthless. The one thing that I am confident to tell you is that in the aftermath of the continued inquiry, the continued just effort to see yourself directly, to get a direct experience of realization. Realization isn't new, it's here, it's you. To get the direct experience of realization, not so that it will wipe out everything and make everything well, like a fairy comes down with a magic wand, not that. But so that you know what you're looking for in the inquiry itself. The only reason for making any effort to speak to you and to persuade you to do the inquiry, to try to trick you into seeing what it is that I am speaking about, the only reason for all of these words, the only reason for speaking of graininess and all of that, the only reason for that The only reason for any of it is to encourage the evoking within you of the recognition of what's already always here. Not in order that it will wipe out and change everything and fix everything, but so that you know what you're looking for as you continue the inquiry. So that you know where to look as you continue the inquiry. So that you know what we're talking about when we say realization as you continue the inquiry. Because it is the inquiry, which is a word by which I mean the continuing, uncomplicated coming of attention to this underlying experience of being, to the spaciousness in which all of this rises and falls, the turning of attention there again and again, simply, not as a big serious thing, just simply, again and again. Because it is that simple glancing at reality that does everything, that fixes everything, that wipes out fear. It is that. And not any flowery descriptions of reality, and not any accurate philosophical understandings of reality, of determinism or indeterminism, of free choice or no free choice, of will or no will. These things are all means only to try to evoke in you this that you are. The words are beside the point. The descriptions are beside the point. The interpretations are beside the point, no matter how beautiful, no matter how gorgeous, they're all beside the point. They all have no purpose and no usefulness whatsoever, except insofar as they serve this this possibility of seeing directly for yourself what's true, what I am really, what's here. For yourself, not to be like you imagine the Buddha to be. The Buddha is just like you. Not to be like you imagine Ramana to be. Just for yourself, to see once and for all the truth of the matter. Not in order that you can gain the experience of oneness and bliss and emptiness and any of that, but just to see for yourself the truth of the matter, the actual truth of the matter. So, that's it. That's my sermon for the day. I want to have full disclosure here. None of my words, none of the things I say, should be taken with any seriousness whatsoever. None of the things that I say that seem to come from interpretation of reality or description of reality or anything like that, understanding of reality, you should just dismiss that. The only thing that I say that's of any use to you at all is look at yourself. Just look at yourself, and all these things will be made clear to you. Look at yourself. Keep looking, and all these things will be revealed, and you'll see what all the fuss is about, which is you. Nothing special, just you. So I'm happy to talk to you now. We don't have to talk about this. We can talk about anything you want. And I guess you guys know how to raise your hands here, right? By talking to Carla? Okay.
Dion is calling from Birmingham, United Kingdom.
Hello, Dion.
Hi, John.
Hi, what can I do for you? Is that the way you pronounce your name?
Yeah, it's Dion. Okay. Well, first of all, John, it's a real privilege to speak to you. And before I ask my question, what I was going to say was that I think you're very, very clear. And when you speak from the heart, it's pretty unmistakable what you're saying. And it's utterly beautiful, actually. My question is really about, it's something to do with choice. Because for years now I've been on this Advaita trail, or whatever you want to call it, self-realization trail, and there are times when I get utterly, utterly frustrated. And I read your small biography on the website, and totally understood how you felt after becoming disenchanted with the feeling of bliss. And although I have to say I haven't reached that stage, or. And so I wonder why I come to these things and listen to these things like I know inside and out intellectually, and I know it's not an intellectual thing. I just wonder whether you can explain whether there's something other than the intellect that happens on these things. I mean, it boils down to whether we need gurus or that kind of question. It's just that deep frustration, John, about how... I've got no choice in this. I can't choose it. And sometimes I cry out to say, look, I want this with all my heart. There's nothing I want in this life but to realize what's going on, what the truth is. And it seems to be out of my hands.
You know, Ramana also said, and in fact it was this that really kind of in my misery, kind of got my attention and made me become very focused on the Ramana's method. Ramana also said, the only thing standing between you and self-realization is the belief that you're not already realized. And this is an astonishing thing to say, and of course, how can you possibly do away with the belief that you're not already realized, since it is actually the belief that you are not already realized that gives rise to all this desire to come realized, to see the truth, to actually know directly, without question or confusion, what's real, what you are, and so forth. The one thing the idea that this whole thing about doership is problematic. It is certainly an article of faith in Advaita circles and Advaita teachings that the attachment to doership is a serious issue that must be dealt with. And it's certainly this whole business around the doer and choice and things of that nature can be very, very confusing when we try to sort them out to make sense of them. And for that reason, I just kind of discarded the whole issue. Here's the deal. It certainly feels like I have the capacity to decide to move my attention in a very unsophisticated manner, looking around within myself for the reality of what I am. It's certainly this conviction is itself invisible. It is certainly the conviction of being the doer, but what do I care about that? As long as it feels to me like I can do, and there's something that I absolutely have to do, then I will continue doing so and not worry about these matters. If you would know about the doer, then you have to look for the doer. And if you are convinced that there is no doer, then, well, what a problem that is. I kind of distracted here because the phone's ringing here. The main thing about all of this, Dion, the main thing that I have to say about all of it is that there's be entertaining, and it can actually produce good feelings and so forth, to spend a lot of time looking among these thoughts and these ideas and these understandings and these concepts in order to, I guess, resolve the contradictions and so forth. But the only way to resolve these matters in the end is to find out for yourself. And since what we're speaking of always is yourself, we're not talking about Ramana's self or the Buddha and Sherman's self. We're talking about yourself. That's all we're ever talking about. You are uniquely and magnificently positioned to find this out for yourself, to look for yourself, yourself, no matter what yourself is that we're talking about. Do you follow that at all?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, excuse me one second. I mean, I don't remember. Tell me.
No, I was just going to say that I think the frustration arises. I mean, it's not always there, but sometimes I sometimes feel cheated, you know, because I think I've been at this game for so long, and you know, I don't very often feel that any great strides have been made. And you know, people quote to me things like, "Oh, son, the door's always open for your return." And sometimes it drives me mad, that, because I think it's not. It's bolted. It's double bolted.
Hey, really, really. Let me interrupt you again. You know, really, the door is always open. There's no door for you to go through. There's no other room for you to go into. The actual reality of things is just as they are right now. The reality of the actuality of what you are is this ever-present non-absence that is known and knowable always. So the whole thing that trips us up is this idea that we are going somewhere or changing something or getting rid of something or getting hold of something or going through some doorway or out some window or into some wormhole, when the fact is all that realization and realizing that you are always here, never absent. And that you always know that. And that all of the efforts to find yourself in some other idea of what you should, or to go through some door, or to make some new universe appear in which you can play, is all there is to the problem. You are here. You are here. And what's wanted is to this fruitless, miserable, running about, trying to figure out how to get where I should be when I am always here and can't move from here. Do you hear this?
Yes, I do, John. Yeah, there is no door. Yeah, that sort of sums it up really, doesn't it? Yeah, that's great. I mean, yeah, it's lovely. Thanks for that.
And you know, it's not, it's, and I say that in order to encourage you to, you know, there's nothing you can do about the arising of these tendencies. This is all according to the predispositions of the individual people. There's nothing to do about the arising of these tendencies to seek after understanding or seek after a new state or seek after an open doorway or seek after a way to get through the doorway. These things are all part of the apparatus and structure of the personality, and they just play as they will. They unfold on their own. And the underlying current of anxiety and neediness that says this isn't what I want is actually just kind of responding to what is the case. It is not what you want to go get something new. What you actually want is to see the reality of what is ever new, never old, and never changing, and eternal, which is what you are. And the exposure to that can be done to do away with an anxious need to find something new, to do away with something, to make something come. I say that in order to point out to you that that there's nothing you can do about the inherent craziness of the personality. It's not that seeking these things or wanting these things or doing something about these things is something that needs to be done away with, but going on all the time. And in the moments when that is not going on, and even when the moments when that is going on, it is always possible for you to stop for just a second and look and see if it is not the case that you are here, still the same, unchanged by all of the vicissitudes of life, unchanged by all of the seeking for something new, unchanged by even the getting of something new. And it's that, looking at that, that does the work. And there's no need to do anything about all the rest of it. All the rest of it just plays as it will and goes away when it goes away. Do you hear it? Do you follow me?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I understand what you're saying, personality, and I seem to have plenty of that. But I do understand that I can also, I understand what you're saying, that there's nothing wrong with that. And it's, sometimes it's, you hear about awakening experiences, and it's difficult not to be drawn into the idea that my turn must come sometime, which is, I know is actually, that's the way it plays out.
That's okay. Your turn will come. Even though it's already here, it will come. I really want to be as clear as I can be that nothing about the inquiry of Ramana Maharshi has the slightest thing to do about anything that's done by the personality of the mind. It is just fine. Whatever's going on in the mind, just fine. Add this one thing. Look at yourself when you can. And then notice how much more likable and lovable life is as the inquiry proceeds, okay?
Yeah, thanks, John. That's really kind. Thanks.
Jan is calling from the Netherlands.
Hi, Jan. Hello, John. It's very good to you tonight. Thank you for all your efforts in talking to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Is it correct to pronounce your name Jan?
What? That is correct, yes. Isn't the great secret of what will be the result of it all not just the ever-silent, observant, wise and non-moving nature that has always been and will always be in the core of my presence?
I read that email, right?
Yes, that is right. Yes, that is right. Sorry, I lost the button. I was saying, forgivity of my vocabulary. It's the first time that I participate in a wonderful worldwide event like this, but it's kind of difficult for me to express in your language.
Oh, that's okay. Simple is all. And you speak my language really.
Okay, thank you very much. John, thank you so much for all the words that pop up from your gracious heart. That is the first thing I said. It's not just a question of understanding what you say, but it's a recognition of what is said because it's from the heart. Is that clear?
Yes, it's very clear. I see that.
Okay, it's an honor to be here. And I feel great to realize that our words spread all over the world at this moment. That's a great event. Now, about the self-inquiry. self-inquiry, looking at yourself, acting in this life. Isn't that right? Is that correct?
I heard you say it is nothing more than something this life. I didn't hear what you said before this life.
In my opinion, the definition of self-inquiry is the constant looking at yourself.
It's not necessarily constant. Often as it occurs to you to do so. The problem, I'm just going to quibble about the word constant, because we have inherited an enormous burden of spiritual utterance from all that carry with them an undertone of this is something that you have to do all the time, or this is the way you have to be all the time. And in my view, that undercurrent is, because the truth is that we can't do anything all the time or constantly, but what we can do in the case of self-inquiry is look at ourself or look for the reality of ourself. It occurs to us to do so, recognizing that it's not a duty or an obligation. It is actually an adventure, and that it isn't as serious as we make it out to be, since we have persuaded ourselves over all these thousands of years that this business is deadly serious and we are at risk of losing heaven and falling into hell if we do it wrong. So words like constantly, I always quibble with. It is really lighthearted. There is no possibility of you not being able to see what you are, since you are here all the time, since you are the only phenomenon that is never absent. It is actually quite easy once you get the taste of what it is that I'm pointing to, this underlying eternal presence that I'm pointing to. Once you see that it's always here, that, oh yeah, that, then it's no trouble to come back to it again and again as it occurs to you to do so. And it is that coming back to it again and again that gradually does the work. Do you follow me?
Yes, John, that's very clear. I have a question, though. I don't know how to put this. Does this self-inquiry has anything to do with self-improvement? Looking at yourself, seeing what you do, and thinking, well, next time I will do that differently. Is that a part of self-realization and self-inquiry?
Do you mean that in regards to the inquiry itself or more generally?
Well, both, actually. You pick your choice.
Well, in regards to the inquiry itself, it is actually a practice like any other practice, and you will gain in skill as you pursue it. You know, you'll see, oh, right, oh, now I see, now I should, maybe if I do this, maybe if I turn this way or whatever. So the practice of self-inquiry, like all practices, is something in which your skillfulness improves as time goes on. Now, if the question is whether the general self-improvement practices in your day-to-day life impinge on the self-inquiry itself or are a part of it, no, not really. They're not. There's nothing wrong with it. There are many things that can be done in ordinary life to perfect and make, you know, better the personal apparatus to make it more smooth acting and so forth. And there's even therapy that is useful in that regard. All those things that we do in our day-to-day lives to try to make the life better are very useful in making the life better, or they can be, but they have nothing whatsoever to do with self-inquiry. Self-inquiry, in the inquiry itself, the stuff that's happening in the life is not irrelevant. It's just beside the point. It's not uninteresting. It's just beside the point of self-inquiry. So it's quite possible to become more skillful in by observing the way that you conduct the inquiry, become more skillful inquiry in the inquiry, and the lessons you've learned in day-to-day life in that regard can be brought to bear in the inquiry, but not the other way around. The things that happen in day-to-day life are beside the point to the inquiry. Do you hear that?
I understand, John. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm happy to speak with you.
Yeah, same here. Thank you very much.
Okay, who else? I want to say while we're waiting for the next person that this that Jan has pointed to is important. This whole business of the role of the way and how it affects it, and my insistence on saying that it is beside the point is really important. It's not that when I say it's beside the point, I really don't mean that it is unimportant or uninteresting or of no use or of no value to do things within your day-to-day life that make you more effective in your day-to-day life. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that that is unimportant or uninteresting. I'm saying only that it is beside the point of the inquiry. And when the adventure of the inquiry is in place, it's just beside the point of the inquiry. Not wrong, not unimportant, not anything negative, just beside the point. The inquiry is all I have to speak about. The continual bringing of attention back to the adventure of getting the taste of yourself, the feel of yourself, the experience of yourself as a, that's what I'm talking about always. So who's next?
Nigel calling from Madrid.
Hi, Nigel.
Hi, John.
What can I do for you, my friend?
Well, it's just, I don't know, carrying on from what you're saying, really, with the last question. The question of effort, really. It seems that it is necessary, you know, to want this, no?
Is it necessary to want it? That's a prerequisite. Is it necessary to want it in an absolute sense? No, it's not necessary to want it in an absolute sense. It's not necessary to do anything about it in an absolute sense. The fact is, as was pointed out to me in this letter, that there is no problem, never has been a problem, that it's not even a problem that these lives are fraught with misery and suffering and fearfulness and anxiety. But surely, if fearfulness and anxiety and misery and suffering if you want to get rid of those, then it is certainly necessary to want to get rid of those, to want to see that you want to get rid of those. Actually, everybody wants to get rid of that, but to see that, let me just say this. In my experience, there is only one desire, never two. And this, without regard to what I'm speaking about when I say desire, I'm speaking about this mute, energetic, sensational experience that arises within us that seems to want something to stop or want something to be had. And there is only one desire in my experience, and that is the desire to see what I am. Now, as I have been saying throughout this session, when I say those words, the desire to see what I am, I have no idea what you hear when I say that, and it's not exactly what I mean to say anyway, but it's as close as I can come right now. This desire to see what I am, in my experience, is the only characteristic of awareness. The only characteristic of awareness. In fact, if we speak the word awareness, we must see that the essence of the concept of awareness is the desire to see. Since there is nothing...
Sorry.
Since there is nothing but awareness, there's nothing to desire to be seen other than awareness. So, that is my experience. That's the single desire that plays. Now, within the life structure, within the structure of the personality itself, this desire gets fragmented and projected and interpreted and broken into pieces and projected on this thing and that thing and the other thing. But all along, even in that fragmentation, it can be seen that all of these things that we project this desire to see myself upon, we do so serving a greater need to see what I am, or to become what I want to be, or to become what I want people to think I am, or something along those lines, all of which are just echoes of this pure desire to see myself, which is the force that gives rise to it all. Is that helpful?
No, that's very clear. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. And so, choice, the only choice that with that desire is using the ego, the desire mechanism of ego, to actually project into simple awareness.
That's correct. That's very well said.
So the other thing I wanted to just ask you about, do you see any great difference between the inquiry of looking into the self and, say, for instance, just being present, being in the now, observing what is, to me, to be the same thing, really? But is there any difference there, you feel? Is there really a demand for a constant questioning, a constant looking, a dynamic inquiry?
Well, you know, now here we go into the realm of expression. I don't know what's meant when it said be in the now, be in the present, be here now, since the actual reality of the matter is that I am not only never absent from the present and the now and the here, I am actually the now and the here. So these encouragements seem to me to be along the lines of, well, I guess what I am, which of course is logically absurd. So I don't know exactly what's meant when these things are used. I know exactly what Ramana speaks of when he tells us to find out who we are, or to look at reality of what we are, or to see what it is to be. I know exactly what he's talking about. And I know that in the beginning of my adventure with this teaching of Ramana, that it certainly required for me that it certainly was required of me, if for no other reason than that this is the way it actually unfolded, it was certainly required for me to be extremely energetic and dynamically committed to the task of seeing what in the world this guy was talking about. And I know that the time comes when that energetic, dynamic activity, action, the dynamic and energetic aspect of it begins to fade as it is, as the actuality of the ever-presentness of the experience, the seeing of reality asserts itself over time. But I know that for me, in the beginning, I had to forget all I knew about being here, all I knew about all of those other practices, and I tried a lot of them. Forget all that I knew about them, forget all that they had taught me about how I really was and who really should be and so forth, and just become really one-pointed and without any distraction every time I thought of it, every time it occurred to me, just really bring a laser-like focus to the effort to see what in the world is Ramana talking about. You see, that's what we have to do. I talked about this somewhere recently. We have to try to prove false the claims of all our teachers. We have to try to refute their claims, not to realize them or to make them real, but to refute them. We have to try to see directly what in the world that they are talking about actually for ourselves. For ourselves, not just for ourselves, not to take anybody's word for it, not to take anybody's description of it. And it's that energy that serves us, the energy to see for ourselves. What is Ramana talking about? What is John Sherman talking about? What in the world is the Buddha talking about? And that one-pointedness and that dynamic, energetic attitude served me unbelievably well. Now, of course, it is absolutely apparent to me that it has always been absolutely apparent to me what's real, what's here. Do you follow me?
I do, John, yeah. I have that hunger. I really do. It's a burning hunger. I mean, nothing short of desperate. But one last thing, and I'll try and be quick. In the end, looking for the truth, really, it's not a looking, there's nothing to see.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. There's nothing to see that you don't already...
It feels like you're looking for something. It's objectifying this thing that you're looking for. Do you know what I mean? And there's nothing, it seems like that you cannot objectify it. So it's, in the end, it's a dying of that... of that ultimate desire.
In the enactment of the inquiry, I'm going to say a couple of things here. First of all, in the enactment of the inquiry, it can be expected, and I'm talking to everybody that's here, right, and everybody who will hear this in the future. The enactment of the inquiry in the beginning, you can expect that you will find yourself fixing your attention on objects within your mind. By objects, I mean experience, sensations, sensational experience within your mind. And the things that feel, that seem to feel like you feel, and or feel like you imagine that people, what people are talking about. And of course, that's total objectification. There's no question about it. Anything that you can form a discrete experience of is objectification. And there's no question about it. And there's no question also that you are not an object within yourself. You are that in which all objects come and go. But that doesn't matter, you see. That's part of the whole thing that I really would like to get across to everybody. That doesn't matter. The fact is that you can't do the inquiry wrong. The fact is that it is And I've said this before, and I've kind of stopped saying it because it's not exactly what I mean. But the fact is that the intent is everything. And that's not exactly what I mean, but I think you can hear it. It is the fact that you are looking desperately to get a glimpse of yourself is what matters. And the fact that you fall on, that your attention falls on objects is beside the point. It will, you will learn as you go along. As to whether there is anything to be seen, you see, it's like, it's just like this thing about the wine, right? About the graininess in the wine. If you read about wine, and you know this whole business of wine, there's a huge to-do about it in the world, always has been, all the subtlety and the sweetness and the deep, nuanced understanding of the flavors and so forth of wine. But if you ever pay any attention to wine and somebody tells you about the graininess of a red wine, you have an idea of what they're talking about. But until you have the actual experience of that graininess that's connected with the word graininess, you really don't have a clue what they're talking about. And it's the same with this business of looking for the reality of what you are. I tell you that the reality of what you are is ever present and absolutely apparent and unmistakable. But so long, and there's nothing you can do about this. This is why the objectification in the inquiry is so common, and why it really doesn't matter. There's no way in the world that you ever, ever, ever will be able to find anything that conforms to the ideas that inevitably play within your mind about what the nature of reality is. You can never find anything like that, which is the reason why the reports of nothing there are so widespread. Another reason for the widespread nature of the reports is because anything we say in the end just doesn't hold up over time. So the objectification of things is to be expected and inevitable. The forming of objectified experiential sensation within the mind in the course of the inquiry is absolutely to be expected and is no problem whatsoever. If you look at whatever object appears and if you hold it tightly with your attention, this is what Ramana means when he speaks of grabbing ego by the throat, by the way. If you hold it tightly with your attention, you will find that it disappears, leaving, well, what seems to be nothing, but what really is you. Just not you in a way that conforms to any understanding of what you think you look like or what you think you feel like, but what remains is you. And it is not nothing. It is not something either. The language of something and nothing, of absence and present, don't apply here. Not because it's so difficult or so esoteric, but just because words are such clumsy and clunky ways of speaking about things. Is that helpful?
That's crystal clear as it usually is from your lips. That's great. Thanks very much, John. All the best. Love to Carla.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'm always happy to speak with you, Nigel. Always happy to speak with everybody. Is there anybody else? One more? Good, then. We can go home and go to bed. I don't mean that. I'm happy. You know, I have to say that these meetings with you, wherever I find you in these online meetings or in meeting halls or on the phone or in person or or wherever I meet with you, these meetings give me life. They are my breath. If I ever say anything that's of any use to anyone whatsoever, it's because of the time I spend with you in whatever venue we find ourselves. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your time. I thank you, thank you, thank you for being here. Thank you for your interest in actually embarking upon the adventure of self-inquiry, your interest in seeing what's possible here. You know, it's the spiritual cloak that causes the rejection of life as, oh, I don't know, something that's irrelevant or something that's beside the point or something that's the problem or something like that. It's some kind of spiritual cloaking. Because the truth is that life is sweet. Life as a human being, the human-heartedness of us all is magnificent. And the possibility that's present here in this willingness to try the insight of Ramana Maharshi, to try the possibility of actually doing the inquiry and seeing whether there's any truth to this at all. This is so exciting. And this is fraught with such possibility for the story of human beings, the story of humanity. Such possibility, I feel like we're, as human beings, we're quivering on the edge of something new. So thank you. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your emails. Thank you for your conversations. Thank you for your presence. Thank you. Carla's going to talk to you for a couple minutes, and I'll see you again whenever and wherever I see you. I love you all.